So, I'm giving everyone a chance to leave, so you know what you're getting into. I'll be going to be talking for the next 50 minutes. Question?
I
mm-hmm. If you're new, I would, well, if you are interested in the way the big book tells you how to do the steps, I would stay. Okay. I'll give you a website that you can get anything you want off it. It's I have a website where it's have a. Oh, well, I don't know if it's valuable to take notes. Okay. My name is Laurie. I'm a compulsive overeater. This is a mini big book study. This morning we're going to be doing steps 1, 2, and 3. And it's basically a talk as to how the big book, what the big book's instructions are for working the steps. And throughout the day, I'll be talking about steps 1, 2, and 3 this session. The next session will be step 4. The session after that will be steps 5 through 7. The session after lunch will be steps 8 and 9, and then 10 and 11, and then 12. And unlike the keynote talks I'm giving, I'm going to be talking about the big book itself. I don't do that in the keynote talks, but here I'll be talking about the big book. And for those who are new to this program, the big book is the book Alcoholics Anonymous, which was first published in 1939. And it is the book that served as the basic text for AA for many years. Many of us in OA, not everyone, like the big book as a set of directions. It needs to be adapted. It needs to be understood. Some of its language is not easy. It's arcane language. It's old language. The person who wrote most of it was schooled in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and he had a lot of big words. I mean, look at our traditions. When did you ever come across the word lest before, you know, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. And it's also written from a male point of view, because at that time the alcoholics that they knew were all male. And it's hard to read for women, and it's hard to read for anyone who has any sensitivity to women, because the chapter to the wives talks about the poor little girl at home, you know, it seems to be condescending. It also is written from a basically Christian perspective, not even a Judeo-Christian, I would say. As for someone like me, an agnostic, it sometimes is hard to read as well. After I say that, though, I will tell you that I think it is one of the most brilliant books ever written. It is one of the, evidently one of the largest selling hardcover books in the world. And it has something in it that I would never try to change. It's just worth it. I've been taught by many, many people ways of understanding this book, and it's I'm very grateful to them, and I'm giving to you what I've learned from them. So, yeah, also, there's a website which is a very simple website to remember the name of, OA Big Book, all one word, OA Big Book. .info, so information about OA Big Book. And on that you'll find all kinds of things you can download, for free, of course. I mean, there's no charge for these things, which include certain forms that I'll be discussing in step 4 and step 8 and 9 and step 11. There's a book I've written that's available to you on the steps, and there's some links to a podcast and to other things, all available for you if you want. I talked in my keynote yesterday about steps 1, 2, and 3, and what I want to do today is talk about it from the big book perspective specifically. I have the copy I took with me is a very small copy. The big book normally is a larger book. It has the first 164 pages plus a bunch of stories, which are wonderful. But I traveled with a backpack, and I decided I wasn't going to take it with me today on this trip. So I talked yesterday about the problem that certain foods give me a reaction in my body that create cravings in me that I cannot overcome. And not all foods. I said radishes have never done that to me. Cow brains have never done that to me either, funny enough. Instant coffee has never done that to me. But there are some foods that absolutely get me going. And I talked about the, you know, the hand going to the mouth and not being able to stop and saying, no, it's time for me to stop, time for me to stop. And I just couldn't stop. And I saw, as I spoke yesterday, a lot of nods in the audience. I mean, people do understand that feeling. The big book talks about this in a chapter right at the beginning called The Doctor's Opinion. And this was a chapter written by a doctor named William Silkworth, who treated Bill Wilson, who was the author of the of most of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, most of the big book. And Dr. Silkworth treated thousands and thousands and thousands of alcoholics, mostly to no avail. He dried them out, he lectured them on how dangerous alcohol was for them, and they would go out and get drunk again. And this had happened to Bill three times already. And Dr. Silkworth had developed a theory which was radical in those days. Everyone thought that alcoholism was sort of a disease of the mind, and that you sort of just had to show your willpower, or as we have heard often enough in OA, your won't power, and you know, push yourself away from the table, push yourself away from the bar. It's just moral weakness that keeps you an alcoholic. But Silkworth had developed a theory that explained, to at least to Bill's satisfaction, and certainly explains to my satisfaction, why in the face of all kinds of reasons for me to want to quit, I could not quit. It explains to me why, in the face of all indications that I had control of many things in my life, that I was a very able person, able to do a lot of things, why I couldn't control myself. And that theory was that we have two problems. One is an allergy of the body, and the other is an obsession of the mind. And the allergy of the body is, I mean, that's a word that we think of nowadays as meaning a cough, a rash, you know, hives, the things we get when we come into, or anaphylactic shock from peanuts or shellfish or something like that. And that's what we're used to by the word allergy. But in fact, the word allergy is a very relatively modern word. It was first used in the early 1900s. And all it meant when it was first used was an abnormal reaction to something. Not a particular kind of abnormal reaction, which is like hives or anaphylactic shock or something like that, but any abnormal reaction. And what Dr. Silkworth isolated was that an alcoholic gets an abnormal physical reaction when he or she ingests alcohol, and that abnormal reaction is cravings, the need for more. And he talks about that in The Doctor's Opinion. I'm not going to give you page references or anything like that because this is a mini study. I don't have time to sort of go through it in great detail. But this is what he says. He says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive, it flees from them, that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And I remember when I was going out with my wife, and I talked about it yesterday as being a person who could eat and stop eating and stuff like that, I had my doubts about whether I wanted to marry a woman who I thought was sick because she didn't enjoy food the way I did. You know, so, I mean, to them, their alcoholic life seems a normal life, normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. And if you're like me, you have experienced a time when you've taken a bite of something and you've gone, ah, I'm at home. I know where I am. This is where I'm comfortable, a sense of ease and comfort. Now, I feel when I have eaten the foods that I know cause my problems, I have felt a sense of ease and comfort. It goes away. I keep having the food, it comes back. It comes back maybe only for a second, but I keep having that, I have had that feeling. Most people, when they eat too much, get a sense of unease and discomfort, as I do when I drink too much alcohol. I get unease and discomfort, as my wife does when she even eats too much chocolate, even though she loves chocolate. I've never had a feeling with food of unease and discomfort. I've been full, I mean, my body has rebelled against it, but my mind and my whole sense of being has always felt this sense of ease and comfort, and I keep grasping for more. So the allergy of the body is the first thing that Dr. Silkworth isolated. There's something in your body. How it got there, I don't know. It maybe it's because you abused your body at a certain point and your body wanted more. Maybe it's because you were born that way. I mean, you know, I don't know what studies about cancer say, but I'll make you bet that there are some people believe that some people are cancer prone, but if they never come into contact with things that cause the cancer, they don't get cancer. But if they do, I mean, there may be people who, if they never smoked, would never get cancer, but if they smoke, would get cancer. Vice versa, there may be people who smoke. Well, there are people who smoke and don't get cancer. So there may be something pre-existing in the body. It may be something we've abused ourselves with. I don't know what it is. But all I know is that from Dr. Silkworth's perspective and from my experience, I have an allergy of the body. There's something wrong with my body. And the big book says about that in the same chapter, the doctor's opinion, the writer of the big book. In this statement, he confirms that we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe. There are musts in the big book. We must believe certain things. That the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. But we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. So from the big book perspective, and also if you look at page 2 of our OA 12 and 12, you'll see almost exactly the same words being used. We have something wrong with our bodies. And it is a disabling fact. And we must believe it. Because if we don't believe it, we will fall prey to all kinds of other thoughts that have never allowed us to tackle the issue of our addiction. And there are 4 good reasons for believing that we have an allergy. First of all, it relieves us of guilt. The fact that I have eaten like a pig and haven't been able to stop no longer makes me feel guilty that I've done that. My body was doing that. And I can't stop blinking. I can't stop my heart from pumping. I can't stop my body from doing some things which it must do. I might be able to stop from blinking for a minute. I don't even know if I can, but certainly for a short time. At a certain point, I have to blink. So I don't feel guilt. Secondly, it tells me that I have a particular problem which if I abstain from certain things, I won't have anymore. Right? If I stay away from things that cause me this allergy, I then will not have that problem. Right? If I have an allergy to shrimp and I get an anaphylactic shock, to avoid an anaphylactic shock, I don't eat shrimp. And that's the clear answer. The alcoholic now knows I can't drink alcohol in any form because once I start, my body develops these uncontrollable cravings, which mean that I can't stop my body from wanting more. The third is, and for OAers in particular, third reason is that it gives us a guide as to how to figure out for ourselves what it is that we have to abstain from. Because there's no question, my experience is clear. I mean, I've had a lot of experience in this program, and I've talked to lots of people about what causes their cravings, is that each one of us has its own, his or her own issues with foods and eating behaviors. And so we have to figure out for ourselves, in our pamphlet, The Dignity of Choice, which talks about that and represents the group conscience of OA, says very clearly that we shouldn't accept anyone else's food plan as being necessarily the right plan for us. Because it might not be the right plan for us. It might be the right plan for someone else. It might be the right plan for all kinds of people. You know, certainly I've shared my plan of eating with a lot of people, and they all get something, well, not they all, but a lot of them say, yeah, I have those problems too, and I'll follow a lot of what you've said. But they also have other issues, as I have other issues, which don't overlap. And so they do their own thing, and I do my own thing. I can't eat any butter. I have a good friend in this program who's been in this program longer than I have. He has a pat of butter. If he goes out, he'll have a pat of butter with a roll or something. It doesn't bother him. It would kill me. Because once I started to eat that butter, I'd be into the ice cream within 6 months. So it tells us that we have to search for ourselves what causes our own cravings. The alcoholic doesn't need to do that. The alcoholic knows no alcohol in any form. Now, people say, oh, yeah, you know, it's so much easier, in a sense, for the alcoholic. They just don't have to drink, but we have to eat. And that's not true. As the pamphlet Dignity of Choice says, the alcoholic has to drink, but the alcoholic can't drink alcohol. We do need liquids in our bodies. We need water. We need something. And I have to eat, but I don't have to eat butter. There's nothing that requires me to eat butter in this world other than the cravings if I get those cravings. So that's the third reason. We can figure out why we need what we need to abstain from. And the fourth reason is particularly important for those of us, and I venture to think there are many of us who are people pleasers in this program. We can say to someone who offers us something, no thanks, I just found out I'm allergic to it. And don't have to feel guilty about turning it down. And if they really push you and they say, well, what happens when you eat this? What kind of allergic reaction do you get? I suppose you could say, well, I certainly say I get cravings, uncontrollable cravings, that once I start, I can't stop, and I don't want to start anymore because I used to weigh a lot more, and I don't want to go back to that because that gets them into OA. And, you know, I have a friend who says that her answer is, I break out in fat. And another friend who said that her answer is, my bum swells up, which I thought was pretty good too. But whatever it is, you know, one of the reasons we've often given for eating is, well, I didn't want to, you know, look different. I wanted to please people. Well, here's your answer. I have an allergy. Who's going to want to give it to you when you have an allergy? To save time in restaurants these days, I now will say, I'm allergic to butter, you know. I was in, my wife and I were on a hiking holiday in Provence. We went to this hotel. It's a wonderful hotel. Great food. Best meal I've ever had in my life. But it starts off, I'm trying to speak in French, which is not too good, to the waiter. And I say, for reasons not connected to OA, my wife and I don't eat meat of any kind. We eat fish. And we're vegetarians. That's the joke. So I said, and he blanched because evidently it was the chef's day off and they had just sort of like a set meal that day in this small hotel. He calls over the owner and the owner comes over and I say, we don't eat chicken. No meat, just no fish and vegetables. Okay. So you could just sort of see it's a 6-course meal. You know, he's calculating and I say, and I don't eat butter or cream. Ooh, he said, my wife said, I do. Anyway, I had the greatest meal I've ever had in my life. I mean, I'll never forget. He brought me, the waiter brought me at one point scalloped potatoes. And I said, any butter in this? He said, no. So I took a taste and I thought maybe there was some butter. And from across the room, the owner said, no, or words to that effect. His French was better than mine. And he grabbed it out of my way and he brought me a plate. And I don't remember all, but there was 3 spears of asparagus, a hard-boiled egg, and some other vegetable. Each one was exquisite. The egg had just been taken from the hen house. The asparagus, I don't know how they were done, but that meal was one of the best I've ever had and was abstinent. I mean, there's nothing in it that I couldn't have. It wasn't in great quantities. It was just all little pieces. But I only point out that I now just say I'm allergic to butter, so I don't get into any hassles. So that's those are the reasons we must believe it. And what are the indications that we should believe it? Well, one is that we can't control ourselves. I mean, it should be that simple. We can control so many other things in our lives. I can control, generally speaking, where my hand is, you know, but I cannot control what happens when I eat ice cream. And so the first thing I have to do in step one is figure out what it is I have to abstain from. I mean, alcoholics take that for granted. Most addicts who join a 12-step program take for granted that the first thing they do is abstain from whatever it is that causes their uncontrollable cravings. And by the way, I don't know if there are any people from Gamblers Anonymous here, but I'll make you a bet, because I've spoken to many of them, that they get a thrill, a bodily physical thrill, something happening, dopamine, I don't know what it is, something in their bodies when they take a risk that I would get nausea from, that I do get nausea from. There's no way I could ever possibly put $5 into, even $5 into something, well, just getting the sense of, ugh, I don't like what I'm doing. Whereas the gambler feels a physical sense that gives him or her a sense of ease and comfort that I don't get. So I even think it goes far, even farther into what have been thought of as the more psychological 12-step programs, but I'm not an expert on that issue. But I'll make you bet that there's something physical there, because I think every 12-step program requires some physical feelings. So I look, when I develop a plan of eating that that allows me to abstain from what it is that causes me cravings, uncontrollable cravings, I look very, very carefully at what causes uncontrollable cravings in me. And I make a list of my binge foods. I do this with people I sponsor. We make a list of binge foods. We see if there are any common ingredients in those binge foods. We decide whether or not those common ingredients are probably the cause or whether they're not. We eliminate all the binge foods, and we begin to eliminate all the other foods that cause cravings. And over the years, I've eliminated a bunch of things that were not among my list to begin with. I also look, and this is because of the OA 12 and 12 mentions this, it talks about on page 3 of the OA 12 and 12 about abstaining from those foods and eating behaviors which cause our cravings. I look at eating behaviors. And I, for instance, I think I said yesterday, I found that one of my eating behaviors is this need to chew all the time. I had another eating behavior, which is I need to be filled right up to my gut, up to my gullet, or whatever this part of the body is, around just around the neck. The gurgle or the zatch, I can't remember what it was. But whatever it is, I used to have to be filled right up to there. And even with healthy foods, of course, that's far too much. So I had to develop ways, a plan of eating that involved eliminating, abstaining from those behaviors that caused me cravings. And so I went back to the simple 3 meals a day, nothing in between, a day at a time. When I said nothing in between, I could take liquids, but I could not chew or suck anything while I was in between my meals. I also, because that kept me from chewing all the time. So I wouldn't chew. That was tough to do at the beginning. I used to chew the ice from the drinks I had. I used to chew my pencil nibs and, you know, because I just wanted to get my body going. And you know, taking these throat lozenges, I'm not happy doing that because it gets but I think I'm okay. I'm in a pretty comfortable place, but I have to do that because otherwise my throat would be too much. So over the years, and I eliminated the eating behavior of eating up to my gullet. I ate up to what I understood to be my belly button. Now, a nurse came up to me after I said that and said, "Do you realize that your stomach is above your belly button?" Well, so I didn't realize that. Somehow I think my stomach is stretched a lot, so maybe it's below the belly button too. But I know what it means to me. I have a friend, though, who says, "I don't know what it means." He says, "I don't know where my belly button is, and I have to weigh and measure my foods to make sure that I get the right amount into me and no more." Fine. You look at the dignity of choice. It covers the whole spectrum of ways. But there's one thing that's clear. Every plan of eating that works in OA creates a way of abstaining from those things which cause cravings. And that, for instance, means that if you have only certain foods that you can eat, and some people have a plan of eating that has, we can only eat these foods and nothing else, you certainly, clearly are abstaining from a whole bunch of other foods which you can't eat. Some people weigh and measure, some don't. It doesn't matter. It should be linked to your own eating behaviors and your own cravings as to what you should do in terms of abstaining. That's the first part. And that part of step one is crucial. Now, to develop a plan of eating is crucial because it means you have to figure out a way to abstain from those things that cause cravings. That's not going to be good enough. That's a diet if you don't go on and figure out how you're going to deal with your real problem. Because the Big Book goes into a lot of detail about the problem of the mind, what the Big Book calls an obsession of the mind. And they describe it in a whole bunch of different chapters, but in More About Alcoholism, they describe it sort of this way. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. Control and enjoy. I can have the stuff I want, and I can control my intake of it. And of course, I've never in my life been able to do that. My whole dieting experience has proven to me the impossibility of being able to do that. And yet I continued to try to do that for many years, including 6 or 7 years in this program. I lost my weight. gained it back. How did I gain it back in this program? Because I took back all the foods that I thought I could eat in moderation. I thought I had it licked. I thought, hey, I've recovered. I'm fine. I'm terrific. Why can't I just have a little bit of this? The diets tell me I can. And I gained weight again because I ended up eating into the trough. So this mental obsession comes in many different ways. And the mental obsession, the big book has a whole chapter more about alcoholism on that mental obsession. It gives different kinds of ways in which that obsession has occurred. They discuss a guy who abstained for 25 years from alcohol, and they say, okay, my long period of abstinence is enough. And he goes back and he has a little bit, and then he goes back and ends up dead within 4 years. They describe a guy who has a really bad day. He used to own his own business. Now, because of alcoholism, he works for that business. He has words with the boss. He goes off into the countryside. He has a glass of milk with a sandwich. Everything's fine. Nothing, no problem. Has another glass of milk with a sandwich. And suddenly the thought occurs to him that he could have a whiskey with milk and it wouldn't hurt him. And that to me is the equivalent of, well, this is organic food, so it can't hurt me. You know, it's free-range butter or whatever, you know. You know what I mean? I mean, it's sort of like it's whole wheat flour if you have a flour problem. Whatever it is, it is something that persuades us that we can have it. So this upset, and the other story is that the guy had a great day. Had a wonderful day. Everything's terrific. He'd been abstinent from or sober for a while. Had a great day. And he goes into a restaurant and he says, why don't I have a couple cocktails with dinner? It's fine. And I have a list of 20, 25 reasons why I've gone back to eating. And those reasons have stemmed from the most serious, the ones I discussed yesterday. I'm suicidal. It'll be better if I end it. It'll be better for everyone if I end it all. And if I eat it, if I die through eating, I won't have made my wife feel bad. You know, whereas if I killed myself directly, she would, so I don't want to hurt her. But, I mean, from stupid thoughts like that, despair and loneliness and utter feelings of rejection to the stupidest things, like this is a new taste. You know, you've been good. It's okay. They're all looking at you. You're standing up. She's not looking. You know, you have to taste it to cook it, you know. Whatever those stupid reasons are, whole gamut. And the brilliance of Dr. Silkworth's analysis of this obsession and of the way the big book describes it is that it's obvious from the description that the reason doesn't matter. Because the real thing is your mind just can't stop you from going back, and it'll come up with many, many different reasons, not one of which will be a good one, will be good enough. There's never a good enough reason to go back to the despair that you felt. And yet you always will if you're like me and you haven't found a spiritual awakening. So the vicious circle I described yesterday is described very clearly in the big book through the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. This is designed to make us all hopeless on our own. It's designed to show us that we cannot get out of this vicious circle without help. And the big book spends at least the equivalent of 3 chapters on this issue, if not 4 chapters on this issue. And because of that, I can't emphasize it enough. When I used to sponsor by going straight to step 3, it says how it works. So I just go to how it works. How does it work? But unless I'm ready with step 1 and I'm hopeless, I'm never going to do these things in the way that they really have to be done. Well, I won't spend much more time on step 1. There's a lot I could be, but I won't do that. But if anyone wants to talk about a plan of eating, I'd be happy to work it out with that person. I because I have a lot of experience in working out plans of eating. And you know, but I'll just finish off by saying that my plan of eating is basically that I eat 3 meals a day, nothing in between, a day at a time. I eat up to my belly button. I leave something on my plate. I noticed in the last little while that if I don't leave something on my plate, I end up eating more than I need to. These days, and I will be saying this more in my keynote talks, I found out over the summer I gained some weight, so I have to lose some weight, and I have to stop reading while I eat, or watching TV while I eat. Because for me, that puts me into kind of a lackadaisical mentality. I don't overeat, but I eat more than I need, if you don't know what I mean. So I've stopped reading while eating. Boy, is it boring. My wife likes looking outside the window. I don't like it as much, and I'd much rather read or watch TV, but I don't. And it means that I stop eating a little bit sooner. I avoid all high-fat foods. I do not have any high-fat dairy products. I use cheese a bit for flavoring, but that's it. I will not use it for protein. I avoid any meal that has more than a 10% of calories from fat. Because for me, fats are the problem. High-fat dairy products are killers for me, and high fats are a problem for me. So I avoid anything that's high fat. That's pretty simple for me. A few gray areas. I know I have some trigger foods that I won't eat either. I found some rice cakes that really got to me. I was eating a lot of them. I stopped eating them. I found I was eating a lot of hot air popcorn. I stopped eating that too. I was having it as one of my three meals as my carbohydrate, but I was just finishing the bowl. I just said no. I never eaten above my belly button, but my belly button can move around a bit. I'm going to talk about that when I get to step 10, because it's at step 10 when I figure out one of the reasons I do a step 10, one of the hallmarks is if food becomes an issue again for me. And that means my weight and things like that. I'll talk in step 12 how I think my duty as a recovered compulsive eater is to keep to a normal body weight for the person who still suffers. But I'll talk more about that in step 12. Step 2 in the big book is found basically in two chapters. One is Bill's story and the other is We Agnostics. And step 2 is... So, by the way, step 1 is just an acknowledgement step, right? I mean, it's just sort of, I'm hopeless. Here I am. I can't do anything. It's not a step from the big book perspective that you take. It's just an acknowledgement that you have a problem and you can't solve it. It's despair. It's to put you into that sweet reasonableness that I quoted Bill yesterday saying, that only the dying can have, right? The hope that we get from step 2, which is not a step you take either, it's just a way station in life. It's just a moment in life where you say, I'm going to try something. It's the willingness that is talked about. I mean, there's a lot of discussion in the big book about this, where Bill's friend Ebby comes to him and says, I found religion, and Bill just gets his dander up and he doesn't want to talk about it, until Ebby says to him, no, you don't need to have religion. You can have your own conception of God, and it doesn't have to be my conception of God. And that whole idea that I can have my own concept of what powers me, or what I would, no, not what powers me, what I would like to power me. That's the difference, what I would like to power me. That whole concept is found in the chapter We Agnostics and in There is a Solution, and in Bill's story. And there's a discussion in the step, We Agnostics, that is directed to the agnostic and to the atheist. Reasons why it is worthwhile to be willing to find a higher power. And those are important, not necessarily for anyone in this room who may not be religious, but they're very important they're not important for you to find a spiritual path, but they're important for you to know so you can talk to people like me. And the reasons are pretty simple. The argument is pretty simple. One, you're not doing too well, so why don't you try something else that seems to work for others? I mean, that's just a very, it works for us. Why shouldn't it work for you if you're like us? Two, running around in circles has never been the way that has showed any progress in life. Why don't you get outside the box and try something different? Slightly different way, but they both appeal. And the third argument is the most powerful. You do believe in something. Otherwise, you wouldn't even be arguing with me. You wouldn't care what I thought. You wouldn't want to talk about it. You believe in something. You believe in life. You believe in something deep. Call it God. Because you're not, you're hypocritical if you don't acknowledge that you believe in something that you cannot justify by reason alone. And it's true. I mean, my father calls himself an atheist. I don't think he is, but he's a deeply faithful man. He believes in justice and truth, and he's fought for those things many times at cost to himself. So he clearly believes in something. He just doesn't believe in the God that he grew up with, the God who oversees things. But that's not important. And the big book has, at the end of the chapter, We Agnostics, the most important thing, and this is not just important for agnostics and atheists like me, but it's also important for the deeply religious. And it's this. We were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, bad things happening to us, by pomp, a sense of self-importance, or worship of other things, worrying about what people think of us or money or things of that sort. But in some form or other, it is there. So obscured means blocked, right? It may be obscured, it may be blocked, it may be put into haze by those things, but that's what the problem is. It's deep down within us, and it is. I mean, our deep down beliefs are deep down within us. There's nowhere else they are. We may believe they're outside of us, but they're deep within us. We cannot justify them other than by our faith in them. And I know that from philosophy. I've minored in philosophy. I've read a lot of philosophy, and we cannot justify our core beliefs. We can't reason them through. Even our belief in reason has to be justified. We can't justify belief in reason without using reason. You can't use reason in order to justify reason. So there you are. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly. And we're going to hear about a searching and fearless moral inventory, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there he may be found. It was so with us. So the chapter We Agnostics and step two is designed to give us hope and to give us an indication of where we're going to find that hope. We're going to find that hope deep down within us, that strength, that inner power deep down within us. Our real problem is that we're not connected with it. We've blocked it off. It's obscured by things that have happened to us in our lives, by a feeling of self-importance or maybe a feeling of complete unimportance, and by worship of other things. And if we could get rid of those things, then the deep beliefs within us would rise up and control our minds. We would be living according to the things that we believe in. If we could do that, then we would be free. We would be living according to what we believed in, and our minds would not be confused. You know, we would be able to say, that ice cream, as I say now, that ice cream is poison for me. Why would I eat poison? So for me, people have said in this program, abstinence is the most important thing in my life without exception. I've heard that all the way through. The big book doesn't say that. In the chapter We Agnostics, the big book says this. I'll quote it. If I can find it, I'll quote it. Here it is. When many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important factor of their lives, they present a powerful reason why I want you to have faith.
Where's that?
Oh, it's page 51. And that whole concept is, for me, as long as I'm conscious of the presence of my God, which is a very abstract thought of truth, love, justice, and beauty, I am free. I'm sane. I've got a direct connection. I don't have to do a lot of thinking. I can begin to act, and I'll talk more about this when we get to step 11, intuitively. I can begin to act, bang, I know what to do, instead of always having to think it through and having all my mind, my thoughts confused. Who is the shadow? The shadow knows how to clear men's mind. What does it do? Fog men's minds or whatever it is. My mind is always fogged. But if I got a direct connection, I know what to do. And since I know what to do and I'm sane, I don't have to worry, I can look at that ice cream and say, that's poison to me. So step two gives us the hope and the picture in the big book of what that hope consists of. If I could get rid of the block, the hope is a spiritual awakening, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, or greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. That's the hope. I get that hope by looking at other people who describe their experiences, who tell me and show me that they were like me and are like me no more. And I get that hope by saying, I want what they have, and they're willing to give it to me. Can I have it? I'm despairing. I've dug. What is it they say? You hit your bottom when you stop digging. I've stopped digging. I'm in despair. I cannot succeed on my own. I need help. There's a help right ahead of me. There's a person who used to be exactly like me and is no longer like me now. That sense of identification and hope, that's what we offer in Overeat is Anonymous. How do I get that? Well, you go through a process of getting rid of the things that block you. I'll do anything. At that point, I'll do anything. And then the big book says, okay now, timing is pretty good. We're on step three now. You've acknowledged your hopelessness on your own. You've got some hope, a sense of power. If you could just get rid of the things that block you from the power that's deep within you, the things that you believe in, your core values, whether they're a personal God or whether they're an abstract concept, good orderly direction, now it's time to make a decision. Are you going to go through with this or not? I do want to say, by the way, that people talk about good orderly direction for God. That helped me a lot. I used to say, people say, I get my direction from God, and the religious people I would hear to say, in some way God's speaking to them, either through other people or through their sacred scriptures or through their holy people. And I couldn't get that. I mean, it doesn't mean anything to me. But then I thought to myself, no, there are two ways of getting direction. One is someone pushing you in the right way, and the other is like a compass. You have a compass that's 360 degrees. And truth, love, justice, and beauty is, for me, due north. And all the other degrees, all the other 359 ways are Laurie's way. And if I could just go true north instead of Laurie's way, I'll be in better shape. And that's what so I get my direction by being pulled towards something rather than being pushed. But I don't think it matters. I go the same way. So now we're on step three, and the big book actually begins to talk about the steps at this point. Interesting enough, the big book never talks about step two, other than to write it down, but it doesn't talk in the We Agnostics about step two. It doesn't talk about taking step two. There's no taking. From the big book perspective, you don't take anything. Despair, hope. That's it. And a sense of direction. So now in step three, the big book starts, and this is the chapter how it works. I've gone pretty quickly, I hope at least given you an overview of it. And the big book says, okay, it's now time for us to make a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understand God. What does that mean? They say, what do we mean and what do we do? And the big book answers that by first telling what it means and then saying what we do. It ends up that what we do is just say a prayer. That's all we do. We make a decision. That prayer is our decision. But what it means, the big book spends about two or three pages on, maybe three or four pages on. And it talks about that our real problem is that we want to be in charge of life. We are the actors who want to be the directors. I talked about that quite a bit yesterday. But I want to go a bit more into it because I think the big book has some extremely important words to use. They say on page 60, the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. We have to be convinced of that. We've already been convinced we can't run our food life on our self-will. That step one convinced us of that. But now we have to be convinced that we can't run our life on self-will. It's a little bit of a step to take, hey? On that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever arranging, trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, life, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. And I venture to think, and I really do say this, I think it's true, aside from my family, before I joined OA, I think many people would have described me that way, even though I was not that way. I looked like I was like that. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest, but as with most humans, he's more likely to have varied traits. The big book goes on to discuss this this need to be in charge. Now, it's not a need necessarily that I have to control it, but it is a need, it is a sense of, I know what would be better. And those of us who have spent our time in the basements in the dark, just feeling so awful about ourselves and just isolating ourselves from the world, and I'm one of them, had that same wish to have things different and that same frustration that things aren't going right. And, you know, I mean, I've talked to people who have said, but, you know, the alcoholic is described always as a person who sort of like changes things, goes in and, you know, breaks things up. The alcoholic in the big book is described as this very dramatic person who, you know, falls over, breaks the table lamp, steals, does all kinds of very dramatic things. But most overeaters, for physical reasons at the very least, are not only isolates, but they're couch potatoes. I mean, we are less able to walk. We're less able to do things. We don't do as much. We're not active people. While alcohol appears to be an anesthetic to most people, certainly is to me, it is a stimulant to alcoholics. There appears to be to many alcoholics, not to all, but to many. And similarly, but with food, it all seems to be pretty anesthetic to us, and it just sort of makes us kind of lethargic. So we're not dramatic about this. And I know that I once sponsored a woman, but didn't sponsor her for long, because when I talked about you're the actor who wants to be the director, does that make sense? I said, no, I just tell my kids how they should, you know, for their own good, I tell them how they should function. I'm not in charge. And I said, no, but you have a need to have your kids. No, I'm not selfish. But that is what the big book describes as selfish, wanting your way. The wish that life would be different, the what ifs and the if onlys of our lives. And the big book describes this in some detail and says that our real problem is that we want to be in charge and we're not. And it's not going well. And our motives vary. Sometimes they're a mixture. When I was, when my kids were younger and they didn't do well in school, I remember feeling, well, somehow that reflects on me, that I'm not a good parent, that I'm not teaching them well, I'm not providing them. So there was a little bit of self-seeking involved with my kids not doing well in school. By the time they're older, my concern about my kids is relatively selfless. I just want them to do better. I want them to be happy. I want them to do well in life. And my motives are perfectly good in that respect. You know, as I told you, I come from a Jewish-Russian background. Well, I lost, my family lost no one in the Holocaust. My family all came over in the early 1900s. But the Holocaust weighs on me. And it weighed on me as a kid, and I grew up in the shadow of it in the 50s, and I had an obsession with it. And my guilt may have been self-induced, but the sense of, you know, the horror of that has weighed on me. I didn't want the Holocaust to have existed. I don't want Holocaust to exist now. I don't want people to die. I don't want there to be genocide. I mean, these are all pretty virtuous motives. As I said yesterday, I don't suffer as a result of these things. I'm living a very comfortable life in Winnipeg, Manitoba, the heart of the continent. But the fact that other things are going on that just kill me has been, for me, one of the things that has clouded my mind, tremendously clouded my mind. So the big book goes on in some detail, and it says you have to understand that you have to turn your will over. Your will has to be turned over. Your wish to be in charge has to be given up. You cannot run your life on self-will alone. So that's the will. And then the life part comes, right? We're turning our will and our life over. The big book then says, what does it mean to turn our life over? It means that you have to keep, and the words they use are words that, oh God, they just drove me nuts for years, because they're so Christian on page 62. Says, first of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. That's the will part. That's the will part. And next we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He's the principal. We're his agents. He's the father. We're his children. Tough to understand, but I think that what it means is, for me at any rate, who has a God that's very different, is I have to make sure that I dedicate my life to the truth, love, justice, and beauty that I believe in, to my core beliefs. For the deeply religious person, it means I have to devote my life to the God I believe in. For me, it means I have to devote my life to the things I believe in. But it makes no difference. I have to concentrate on that, and I have to live according to those things, or else I'll go back to eating. So to turn my will over means I can no longer be in charge, and to turn my life over means I have to trust that living my life according to my deepest core beliefs is the only way I can do anything of any value in this world. And those are the two things, turn will and life over. And then the big book gives us the promises. It doesn't tell us how we're going to do it. It just tells us this is what we have to do. This is the only way out. This is the way we're going to become sane. The big book gives us promises. And these promises, a lot of people think these are the promises, step three. They're not. And I can prove that to you if you ever want to talk to me about it. But page 63, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, being all-powerful. He provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. So that's the promise of the entire program. They haven't told us yet how we're going to get there, but they've told us that we need to get there. And then we make our decision, and that's simply step three. It says we found it desirable to take this prayer with an understanding person. It's better to meet God alone with one who might misunderstand. The wording was, of course, quite optional, so long as we expressed the idea, voicing it without reservation. This was only a beginning, though if honestly and humbly felt, made an effect sometimes a very great one's felt at once. And I know that we're just about to finish, so I'll just be very quick. The big book does not promise any great effect after step three. And from the big book perspective, not necessarily from other ways of doing the step, you don't wait around. You make your decision and you go right on to something else. You don't wait for God to hit you in the head. You don't wait for that feeling that is promised to you, because the promise won't come, and the big book makes this clear, until after you've done step nine. Halfway through step nine, some of the promises will come true. So I'll just finish by asking us all to say the step three prayer. God, grant me the serenity. Okay. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Thank you, and in 10 minutes we'll go on to step four.